This is week number three, so welcome to week number three as we get started with our finance class. I'm going to just say a few things. I want to each one of our classes to start with, certainly with a word of prayer, but just a little bit from the scriptures about the finances. And so last week or 2 weeks ago, we talked about the Bible that teaches we're to have a plan. We talked about building a house, building a tower, and of course we don't build towers, but we build families and we build a life. And so we don't want to run out of money before we run out of month, or run out of money before we run out of life. That's even worse. So we plan, and that's important for us to do that. And last week we talked about how God provides for us, and he provides for our needs. And he knows what we need. He knows better than we know what our needs are. And so it's important that that we know that and that we rely upon that. It doesn't mean that we don't do anything. We have to plan. We have to work hard. We have to do all of those things, knowing that all of our strength, everything that we have, God enables us to do that. And so Philippians 4:19 says, "And my God will supply all your need according to his riches in glory in Christ Jesus." And so that's a great truth that God provides for us. This week, I just wanted to give a couple of verses on contentment and avoiding covetousness. It's easy to say, "I want more than what I have." And clearly, we know that God provides for our needs. He knows what we need. Hebrews 13:5 says, "Let your conduct be without covetousness. Be content with such things as you have. For he himself has said, I will never leave you nor forsake you." And that's in line with him providing for us. He never will leave us. He knows our needs, and he will provide for us. And sometimes we think that we don't have enough, but he will provide for us. 1 Timothy 6:8 says, "If we have food and covering, with these we shall be content." Well, what that's saying is that for our basic needs, that's what we need to be content with. We'd all like to have, or at least most people would like to have, a nice bigger car, a bigger house, really big vacation. But the Lord doesn't always provide that. He provides for our needs. And he wants us to work hard. There's nothing wrong with those things. He provides riches for us, but he wants us to use them in an appropriate way that honors him. So we need to learn to be content. This is not a class about getting rich. This is a class about managing what God has given to us and understanding that it comes from him. So let me open us in prayer, and then I'll turn it over to Howard. Our Father, we do thank you for the great and awesome God that you are. You are the creator. You own everything. You own us. And thank you that you've called us to yourself. Thank you that you've given us your word that tells us how we should live. And managing our finances is a big part of that. And we just thank you for all your care for us. Help us to be content with what you have given to us, but let us also work hard and manage our resources well. Pray that you would bless our class tonight. Be with Howard as he teaches. Be with each one of us as we listen. Pray that all that is said and done here will please you and will be helpful to each one of us. And we ask this in Jesus' name. Amen.
Thank you, Dwight. How's everybody? Good. It's Wednesday again already, right? You start thinking about this on Monday, saying, "Yay, what an opportunity." Alrighty, last time we finished up talking about buying an automobile and whether we were going to buy or lease an automobile. We're going to start our discussion this evening on renting a home or an apartment. We're going to talk about buying homes in a couple weeks. So that's going to be part of this discussion as well. But tonight, let's talk about renting an apartment or a home. And let's Turn, first of all, in your notebook to H15. Once again, that's in the back. H15. And this is a list of things to ask, check, and verify. We're not going to go down through the whole list. You can read this as well, or if not better than I can. But I do want to emphasize a couple. To begin with, can you afford the expense, including utilities and renter's insurance, with or without a roommate? Oftentimes, we do our financial analysis of being able to afford something in an ideal situation. In an ideal world, this will work great. Unfortunately, if you and your roommate have a falling out, or if they fail out of school, or whatever it happens to be, and you're left by yourself, can you continue to pay for that apartment or that home? Oftentimes, no. So you've got to have the strategy of how you're going to react or respond should this occur to you. In addition to that, are the utilities included? If not, what are the historical averages that'll be involved? Because the averages can make a huge difference as far as what the overall expense for this apartment or home is going to be. Are blinds or curtains included? And do they work? And if they are included and they do work, can you change them if you desire? In other words, if they are really ugly and you really want something different, will they let you do it? Because not every place will. You need to find out early on if that's a possibility. If it's furnished, is the price for furniture included? Keep in mind, there's the word in here included in a number of places. And sometimes in outside signs for hotels, it'll say HBO free. No, it's not free. It's included. The price has been included in whatever price you're going to pay. The same if the house or the apartment comes furnished. Okay, somehow that is going to be included in the price, but is not free. In addition to that, what is the amount and provision for the refund of the deposit? Here's a big one, folks. Don't take your walkthrough cavalierly. In other words, spend some time doing this properly. I would recommend that you take pictures. If anything is the least bit out of whack, take a picture of it and have them sign and date it. Okay? So that you know that you have proof that this is not all that is being advertised to be. And if there's a problem with the apartment 18 months, 2 years, 3 years, whatever it is later, that they don't withhold the deposit from you without some kind of provision for that. In addition, is the outside well-maintained and landscaped? Is there trash floating around, or is it policed up pretty well? How often is garbage picked up? Is it picked up from your door, or do you have to walk two blocks to a Dipsy dumpster somewhere to deposit it? That's something to check. Is there a resident manager? Why would that be important? Somebody to complain to. Somebody to complain to, other than a phone number, right? Absolutely. Somebody to complain to. And historically, if you have a resident manager, people are going to be, or the facility is going to be more responsive than if you have to go run somebody down elsewhere. Are smoke detectors working and are they present? It's amazing to me how often, even in nice apartment complexes, the smoke detectors are missing. And you don't want to be in a facility like that where the smoke detectors are missing. I would check with the Better Business Bureau and the Chamber of Commerce for potential problems and make sure that the complex does have a good reputation with them. They'll know about the bigger apartment complexes for sure, and they can tell you whether or not this is a good place to live or not. When you're going to go in with a roommate, make sure, even if it's family, that you make this a business arrangement, a business agreement. Okay? It's not just two good friends that have known each other since first grade getting together and hey, man, this is going to be fun. No. Make it a business agreement. Okay? Put it in writing and have everybody agree what's going on before you ever get started. Okay. So let's switch gears and go back to talking about personal loans. And we'll go back to page 17 of your handout again. What is a personal loan? Very simply, it's nothing more than a debt that has been acquired by you. Very simply. Now, there's a number of different possibilities. You can have secured personal loans. What are those secured with? It would be like an automobile or a home. What would that be secured with? Collateral. Absolutely. So if you fail to pay, whatever it is that they are holding in collateral for you is going to be withdrawn from your possession and put into theirs, right? Okay. If it's unsecured, it might be something like a credit card or bank draft, personal loan, and it's really backed by your money in that case. In other words, you've promised that you're going to pay, and if you don't, then they'll take further steps. What's a line of credit? Anybody know? That's right. It's a potential.
The bank loan you can draw on when you need to.
Exactly. And you've got a pre-established agreed upon amount, don't you? So you can just draw on this amount on a regular basis until you've maxed out the entire amount of the draw. And you pay interest only on this until the draw is, or the line of credit has been maximized and you start repaying principal and interest at that point. So it's interest only up till then. What's a subsidized loan? Somebody else pays it. Who? Look around you. We pay it. These are generally backed by the federal government. And if it's subsidized, there's no interest being paid by the borrower because we're paying the interest until the loan comes due. Okay? Unsubsidized loans, just like the name implies, would be what we typically consider to be a borrow transaction. So there are a number of variables, many considerations, and the specifics of the loan are going to be determined by these. If you look at the top three, principal, which is the amount that you're going to borrow, the annualized percentage rate, which is the interest rate that you're going to use to borrow the money, and the length of the loan, those three are fundamentally responsible for the monthly payment, the total finance charge, and the total to be repaid. Now, your credit score is going to go into this as well. That does make a difference as far as those bottom three. In addition to that, the government regulations that are in effect at the time, and the stage of the economy. Where is the economy at that point? That's going to have an impact on the amounts that you pay here as well. So we know that there are different inputs as to the true payment of the loan, but in reality, when you're calculating the cost of a loan, it's real simple. The amount to be repaid is equal to the principal, which is the amount that you borrowed, and the interest that you build up in the time frame of that loan. That's all. It's principal plus interest. Two primary ways of calculating that. We have simple interest and compound interest. Simple interest has a formula that looks like this, where the interest amount is equal to the principal, the amount that you borrowed, times the annual percentage rate, the interest rate, times the number of years. And then the monthly payment is equal to the amount to be repaid totally divided by the number of months that you're going to be repaying on this loan. So let's look at an example. How much interest will be paid each month for a $6,000 loan with a rate of 4% for 10 years? Well, to calculate it, we just use the formula we looked at up here. $6,000 times 0.04, which is 4%, times 10 years equals $2,400 of total interest over that 10-year period. That's really the cost of the loan. That $2,400 then is divided by the number of months that the loan is in place, and we're 10 years, so it's 120 months, right? And so we've got $20 per month in interest that's being paid, which means that our total loan repayment is $70 a month. But I thought that the loan was being repaid with $20 a month, where did that other 50 come from? From the 6,000. That's from your principal, isn't it? The principal of $6,000 divided by 120 months is $50 a month, plus the interest equals $70 a month. So simple interest is pretty straightforward, not a real difficult thing at all. How about compound interest? Compound interest is actually more common than simple interest in most personal loans. The final amount to be paid here is equal to the principal times 1 plus the annual percentage rate, 2, the power of the number of years of the loan. Okay? We're going to run an example here as well. This is exactly the same variables. We've got a $6,000 loan for 10 years with a 4% interest rate, just exactly like we had before, right? So let's apply what we have here. We have $6,000 times 1 plus 0.04, which is the 4%, at the number of years. Now, that 10 at the number of years, I get kind of confused. I wasn't real good in math when I was in ninth grade. But we have an authority, folks, in this room right now, who not only got his bachelor's degree, but got a master's degree in mathematics. Ooh, huh? Our very own Dwight Custis. Dwight, what's it mean when this is at the power of the number of years?
Well, Howard, when you were sleeping in ninth grade, I learned what that was. How many know what the power of 10 is? Okay, most of you do.
Sounds like a trick question.
Yeah, right. If it were the power of 2, let's make it real simple. It'd be the formula would be 6,000 times 1.1 plus 0.04, and then you take another one times 1 plus 0.04. Okay? So when you do this 10 times, the power of 10, you have 10 of those side by side, and you multiply them all out. So you can see that that number grows over time.
Great. Everybody good? Thank you, Dwight. We appreciate you, sir. So when we run through all these numbers, it comes out to $8,881.47. We know that we had $6,000 that we borrowed initially, right? So we subtract that from this number right here. That means we got $2,881.47. That is the amount of interest that we're paying on this loan. We divide that by 120, which is the number of months in 10 years, and we come out to $24.01 per month in interest. So our monthly payment is $74.01. Now, what that means, very simply, is that we're paying how much more than we did before? Yeah, okay. And what does that equal over 10 years? $481 that we pay under this way than we do with simple. And the only difference is the way that it's calculated, right? So it does make a difference how you arrange your financial situation with your bank or your credit union or savings and loan when you go in. Yes, ma'am. You get to pick it by going to the financial institution that will offer it to you. That's how you pick it, is by doing comparison shopping. Okay. So let's turn our attention to one of my least favorite topics. You know, the human cost of debt can be devastating, especially with payday loans. How many of you have heard of payday loans? See a show of hands? Well, let's talk a little bit about these. What are they? They are small, high-interest, short-term cash loans. They're intended to cover the borrower's expenses until the next paycheck, hence the name. Next paycheck, payday loan. They're also referred to as cash advance, check advance, post-dated check, and deferred deposit loans. So we have a loan here that is really so stilted to the lender that it's amazing. And I'll show you why in just a minute. But there is a process that you follow in taking out a payday loan. The borrower writes a post-dated personal check for the loan amount plus a fee, whatever the fee happens to be. It's agreed upon when you start. Okay, the lender holds the check for the loan period and then deposits it, or the customer returns with cash to reclaim the check. So you got two choices. All right, they'll either cash the check that you left for collateral, or you bring cash and pay it off. It's got to be repaid in full on or before the due date. There is nobody who is going, it's doing this type of loans, who is going to say, okay, you tried real hard to get down here yesterday, but you just didn't have it, so we'll forgive it. Yeah, go ahead and just pay off that. No, that ain't going to happen. Not with payday loans. If you're a day late, you're a day late. And all that we're going to see here in a minute is going to happen to you. Loan may incur additional fees and or increased interest rate for failure to pay in full. And it is a convenient short-term solution, but definitely not appropriate for long-term cash needs. So let's apply this process to an example. We're going to assume that you want to borrow $100 for 2 weeks. Pretty simple. Not a problem. You can write a personal check for $115, which is $15, in this case, is the fee to borrow the money. The lender agrees to hold your check until your next payday, assuming it's 2 weeks away from there. When your payday arrives, the lender either deposits the check and you redeem it by paying $115 in cash, or you roll over the loan. If you roll over the loan, you're charged an additional $15 more to extend the financing for 14 more days. If you agree to electronic payments instead of the check, the lender would deposit the full amount. If you roll over the loan three times, though, the finance charge would climb to $60 to borrow the $100. Numbers are getting kind of big. What does that equate to on an annualized percentage rate? That's how we normally think of things, is the annualized percentage rate. There it is right there, folks, 391%. 391%. Is this a good deal? It's a good deal for the lender. Somebody's financial plan's being financed here, isn't it? It ain't yours. This guy's got a huge house over here in Dallas. Yeah, a monster house. Okay. Can you see now why? You know, and you get down here to the point where you're borrowing $60, or you're paying $60 to borrow $100 for just a month or so, and you want to walk on it. These folks will send out Tony the Torch from Chicago to visit you. They don't take kindly to people that just walk. Now, how can they rationalize, how can they justify 391%? They'll say it costs us as much to underwrite a $100 loan as it does a $1,000 or a $10,000 loan. We got to go through the same process of underwriting. Not only that, but the default rates are extraordinarily high. They're very high. People do walk away from these loans. And what's even worse, in my opinion, is that you can get yourself into this cycle of debt where you really never get out of it because you never have enough money on a two-week basis to pay off what you owe, and the loan and the interest continue to grow. Okay? Payday loans are really, really bad. So if you're going to take one of these, before you take a payday loan, verify the license of the lender. It's amazing the number of unlicensed people who are lending money to you. This really is organized crime business right here. That's exactly what it is. Consider alternative solutions. Okay, one of the alternative solutions I've got down here at the bottom, and that is set up a budget, set up a saving plan. How does that solve this problem? You're not spending more than you earn. Plus, you have an emergency fund and you have a contingency account, right? And with the emergency fund and the contingency account, you don't have to go borrow $100 from somebody. You've got it available to you, all right? And you can use that then to satisfy the requirement that you have. Borrow only what you can afford to repay next paycheck and avoid borrowing from more than one lender. The reason is that it's too easy to forget the specifics of the loans. And if you start going beyond the two-week point, and they normally are 2 weeks, if you go beyond that two-week point, then you're going to wind up owing more and more interest to these lenders. So you got to know when your payment date is due and take advantage of organizations that can help with budgeting, credit repair, and that sort of thing. If you Google credit repair, you're going to get hundreds of thousands of hits. They are out there in huge numbers. They are not all created the same, okay? Some are usurious. Some are just flat crooks, okay? So you've got to be very careful. If you're going to try to repair your credit, they're going to charge you, and you may or may not have a credit repair situation, okay? So don't just go to Google and say, okay, this is going to be the solution to my problem, because it may or may not be. Do your homework first. Do your vetting before you just jump on it. Now, there are similar loans to payday loans, income tax refund anticipation loans. You see a lot of these on TV in January, February, March, right? Because they say, okay, Uncle Sam owes you this money. It's going to take them 3 months to get it to you. So this is your money. You need your money. Get it today. We'll take care of this for you for a fee. They will charge you for that. In addition, car title loans, especially in small towns, it seems like you see the car title loans in the little strip malls. And here what they're doing is they'll say, okay, you can continue to drive your car or your truck, and we'll keep the title. Okay, no harm, no foul. In the state of Texas, 1 out of 5 car title loans result in repossession. 20%. Horrible. Horrible. Don't put yourself in the situation where this can happen to you. There's too many other ways of acquiring the proceeds that you need. Okay, before borrowing, and this doesn't just apply to car title loans and payday loans. This applies to any kind of personal loan situation. Explore ways to reduce the expenses. In other words, do your homework. Find out if you can go to a different lender, are you going to have a better situation? One thing. And where can you pare down expenses? How can you negotiate with them? Try to get the best terms, and don't borrow more than you need. We've talked about need versus want. This is the third time in 3 sessions, okay? Need versus want. And the whole concept of need really boils down to controlling your finances. You want to borrow money if you will. In other words, it's part of your strategy. It's part of your financial tactics to do this, and it's going to benefit you. Borrow it if you must. In other words, there's no other alternative. You're in a situation, you've got to have the money today. You borrow the money and pay the price. But don't ever borrow just because you can. Okay? Don't do that, because you're playing into the hands of the people that are making those dollars available to you. Okay? Somebody's financial plan is being financed, and it ain't yours. All right? Avoid that. Okay. Let's switch gears here. We're going to go to the Bible in this case, and we're going to look at Proverbs 27, verse 12. It says, "A prudent man sees evil and hides himself. The naive proceed and pay the penalty." What do you think our next topic is? I know you cheated, you looked, right? It's risk management, okay? Risk management is our next topic. And there's 3 essential ways that it can be accomplished. One is through risk avoidance. What's an example of risk avoidance? Get a budget. Yeah, I like that one. Stop smoking, lose weight. Don't ride bulls for fun. Okay? Would that be one? Don't text while you're driving. That's avoidance, isn't it? That happens all the time. How about risk control? What would be a way to control risk? Don't turn the phone on when you drive. That's doing it. Wearing seat belts. That would be a way to do it. And actually, I heard somebody say insurance. Insurance is risk transfer. That's our number 3 down here. We're transferring the risk from us to another party. In this case, to an insurance company, right? So we have various types and amounts of insurance that'll do this for you. And we find that some people actually believe that only those who lack faith would seek protection through insurance. There are people that believe that. Insurance doesn't prevent accidents. Okay? It doesn't prevent loss. It doesn't prevent death. What insurance does is compensate our families and others for the loss that they experience. That's really what it does. And we find this referring to God's word by going to 2 Corinthians 12:14, 1 Timothy 5:8, and Proverbs 13:22. 2 Corinthians 12:14, 1 Timothy 5:8, Proverbs 13:22. All three of these address this concept of insurance very clearly. The reality is that insurance is not going to cover every catastrophe, every risk, every contingency that we're going to face. It's not designed to. It can't do that, okay? But, and it shouldn't really, but it should be part of a good stewardship plan to watch over and steward the gifts that God has made available to us. How many of you have heard of a fellow by the name of Randy Alcorn? Any of you? Some of you have. Who is he? Yep, he's an author, and he's a religious author. And in his book, Money, Possessions, and Eternity, he asks this question. He says, but where does God fit in all of this? The greatest danger with insurance is that it can undermine our sense of dependency on God. So we want to have enough insurance to protect ourselves and our family, but never undermine our dependency on God. That makes sense, doesn't it? Okay, so we're going to be talking about insurance, and I know for a fact that some of you find this as your favorite topic of all, okay? In fact, I know for a fact that some of you on a cold winter night will curl up on the couch with a cup of hot cocoa and some popcorn and your homeowner's or life insurance policy and spend the most of the evening going through and making sure that you fully understand all of this, because it's so much fun to do that, isn't it? Read these documents that are written by lawyers for lawyers, right? Yeah, they've done a great job of making it something less than fun. But what we're going to do is try to add some clarity to what we have here. And in fact, we're going to talk about 7 different kinds of insurance. Don't check out of the net on me right now, okay? This is going to flow pretty quickly. We got automobile, renters, homeowners, life, health insurance, disability insurance, and umbrella insurance. Okay? 7 different kinds of insurance. And we'll focus first of all on automobile insurance. These are the basics of automobile insurance, and we're going to take these and drill down a little bit to each one of them and see if we can figure them out a little bit more. Let's turn in our notebook to H17. H17. Almost sounds like somebody calling bingo, doesn't it? H17. And what we see are basics in automobile insurance. To begin with, liability, which is for bodily injury caused by you or your legal somebody that you are legally responsible for. It is required in the state of Texas that you have this type of insurance. It protects your assets if you're sued and protects yourself if hurt by an uninsured driver and protects the injured, so we do have a moral obligation to this. Liability for property damage, which is damage that you do to someone else's property. Once again, this is required because it's applying to someone else other than you. Medical payments, which is minimally required in at-fault states. Texas is an at-fault state. And what that really means is that the person who caused the wreck or their insurance company is responsible for the loss of both parties. There's lots of court cases that go into how do you determine who is responsible and who is at fault, okay? But that's essentially how it's determined. Then we have collision. Collision covers repairs to your car. So we're not talking about somebody else's car now. We're talking about yours from accidents, no matter who caused it. And the cost depends upon your deductible. The deductible we're going to talk about in just a minute, okay? But that's essentially the amount that you pay of the risk. Comprehensive insurance is damage to your car other than from a collision. Other than from a collision. So it might be from flood, fire, vandalism, hail, other things. This is also optional. Uninsured and underinsured motorist pays the cost of your injuries if you're hit by an uninsured motorist who is at fault, an at-fault driver who has insufficient coverage, or a hit and run. It also covers lost wages. And that could be a big deal if you're set aside for quite a while. Towing and rental car reimbursement is fairly inexpensive. It's probably a good idea. But if you have AAA or some of the other credit cards, that could be already included in your coverage. And so you need to verify that before you buy it separately from the insurance company. And umbrella insurance, we're going to talk about separately in just a minute. So automobile insurance is pretty straightforward. There are some aspects of it that are required. There are some aspects of it that are optional. And what we're going to look at, if you go back to page 21, we're going to look at some tips on auto insurance. To begin with, as with everything, and you've heard me say this already so many times, you're going to hear it again many times before the end of our sixth class together. But comparison shop. Do your homework. Be an aware and a savvy consumer. Get a copy of the State Auto Insurance Buyer's Guide. Actually, these are well done. They will give you a huge amount of information before you go out and you get involved in getting your auto insurance. Let me give you a couple phone numbers for the State Department of Insurance. 1-800-252-3439. Also, 1-800-578-4677. If you want to go online, you can go online to customer relationship at TDI, that's Texas Department of Insurance, but you just put in TDI.texas.gov. Lots of good information on this. Another organization that you can use, and this is to check your insurance companies and your agents for complaints and that sort of thing, is the NAIC, the National Association of Insurance Commissioners. And so here it would be NAIC.org. And they'll give you insight into the company, into the agents, and give you a lot of information. It's a good place to do some homework because you let your fingers do the walking. Okay, you also want to make sure that if you're going to use an agent or a company, that they are easy to contact, they're easy to get hold of, they return your calls, okay? That's a big deal. A lot don't. Okay? Make sure that they're pleasant to work with. So go through this entire process. Don't buy coverage from the lender who financed your car. Why not? They're going to charge a higher rate, almost without exception. Almost without exception. Buy a car that's inexpensive to repair. How can you determine that? Consumer Reports. Exactly. Consumer Reports puts out an annual report that shows you the relative ease of repair and expensive repair for almost all makes. Yes, sir?
You can go to the library and check it out.
And you can do that. Go to the library and check it out. Exactly. Edmunds.com, yes. Right. And we talked about that when we were looking at buying a car. Talked about Edmunds. Raise your deductible on collision insurance. The deductible is the amount that you pay before the insurance company pays. If you raise your risk, then you're going to reduce your premium, your cost of the insurance. Okay? So you have to balance the two and see where you are going to benefit the most. Drop collision on an older car. Remember, collision only applies to you. If you've got a clunker, and you know for a fact, even if you have a wreck, even if you get the money from the insurance company, that you're not going to fix it, you're not going to repair the damage that's done, then why pay for the insurance that may come through for you? It may come through only because you may have a wreck. All right, there's no guarantees there. Sometimes it could be reasonable. Exactly. Especially if you're bundling, which we'll talk about in a second. If you're bundling and they throw it in almost as a loss leader. Have autos and renters coverage with the same company for a discount. There's your discount, your bundling. Drive safely. Well, that's duh, right? You think? Yeah, because insurance companies know when you get a ticket, they know when you have a wreck. What do you think that's going to do to the cost of your insurance? It's going up. They're not going to absorb that, okay? You're going to wind up paying more, so drive safely. Check your policy for accuracy. It's when you look at the number, especially as you're dealing with larger companies, the number of inaccuracies in policies is pretty significant. You'd be surprised if you really realized the numbers that are out there. So make sure that your policy, which is your contract, reflects what you understood that you were buying. Buy from a company with an A-plus rating from Alfred M. Best. Alfred M. Best, here's another one that you can get at the library. You don't have to buy it. I would not recommend you buy this. It's about that thick. Okay, it evaluates all the companies in the United States that sell insurance according to their fiscal or financial stability, and then it rates them. It says they're excellent, very good, fair, poor. All right, so go down, see if the company is doing well financially, and then pay semi-annually or annually if possible. The reason for that is typically if you go with a quarterly or monthly, the company is going to charge you more for that, okay? But not all companies do. So if you can pay 1/12 of the annual and have the convenience of only doing this on a monthly basis instead of having to lump sum it for an annual, then why not? You have the use of the money rather than the insurance company having the use of the money for that period of time. So those are some tips on the auto insurance question. We can turn our attention now to renter's insurance. And lots of renters don't see any reason at all for having insurance. Let me ask you a question. Let's assume that you're living in an apartment. You're on the second floor. The apartment right below you catches fire. Okay? You don't have a lot of fire damage, but you have a lot of smoke and water damage. How much of that are you going to be reimbursed for by the people who own the apartment complex?
Zippo.
Nada. Zippo. You ain't going to get any, are you? That's right. Renter's insurance is very economical. Now let's take a look at some basics of this. Go to H18, if you would, please. Hotel 18. When you think that you really don't have much, let me encourage you to do a little exercise that might change your attitude on it. Go into your apartment or your home and take everything out of every cabinet, everything out of the closets, lay it on the tables, lay it on horizontal surfaces, and then do an inventory of it and take pictures. Put the picture somewhere outside of your home. Don't put it in a fireproof box back in the closet. All right? Take the pictures and the inventory and put it somewhere else, because now you have something that you can use with the insurance company if you have to file a claim. It will also, as you go through this process, cause you to think, okay, if I had to replace this, if I had to replace all of these CDs and all of these books and all of this electronics, all of my clothes, okay, everything that I've got in the kitchen, dishes and cookware and such, how much would it cost me to replace it? Because that's really what you're looking at, okay? So if you're looking at renter's insurance, the best of those policies will typically cover 17 or 18 different risks. And here are some of them: theft, vandalism, fire, natural disasters, including earthquake, liability protection for injury to others, liability protection for damage to others' property. Those are some of the risks that the insurance company is assuming, which means you're not. All right, so for a cost, it might be something like $5,000 insurance for your property and $50,000 for liability. Okay, if somebody's hurt in your apartment while you're out there and you're found to be liable. If you have a $100 deductible, which is a low deductible, then it will cost you somewhere around $10 to $13 a month, depending upon the company. So it's pretty reasonable, okay? It's a good investment in this case because you look at the potential loss against the potential gain, and it's fairly significant. So renter's insurance is something that I would encourage all renters to have. When my guys moved out of the house, I strongly encouraged them to have it, to the extent that we sat down and worked with the agent and took care of it before they left, just to make sure that it was in place. Okay, back to page 21. Let's turn our attention to homeowner's insurance. There are essentially two ways to value your home. One is cash value, and that is what the property was worth at the time of damage minus depreciation. The other one is replacement value, which is what it would take to rebuild the home with similar quality materials today. If you just look at that, which would you say is probably more expensive? The replacement. Okay? And that's true. And it also can be more value depending upon how it's written and what the policy actually provides for you. There are insurance companies, though, that are providing what I think is misleading advertising, because what they'll basically say is you can get something for nothing. In other words, you can pay for cash value insurance and get replacement value benefit. Very little in this world is something for nothing. Okay? So be aware of what's being offered in that situation. Now, when we look at homeowners insurance, we have two primary parts of the policy. We have property coverage, and the property coverage does the things that you see on the list right there. It also has liability coverage. Liability coverage provides these three things: personal liability, it provides medical payment for injuries that occur on your premises, and personal property of others. So liability is your requirement to provide for others, and the property is essentially what's going to be available to you on your property. That includes all the way down to damage on the items that were outside of your home. So when you look at this, whether it be the liability or the property, you have to be aware that there probably are also going to be exclusions. And these things are not usually covered under standard policy. So we have floods and earthquakes. And by the way, because of the floods that we had last year down in Houston, the Knight area, a lot of places that were being called 100-year floodplains are being reevaluated, and they're dropping to 50-year, 25-year, 10-year in some cases. And if you go from a 100-year floodplain to a 10-year floodplain, it means that your coverage could be more expensive, and it means that you might be required to buy flood insurance in a separate policy if it's not being made available in your particular homeowner's policy. Okay? So be aware of that. It's probably going to be coming, not so much up here as down in South Texas, but Texas is going to be impacted by it. And when we find things like tornadoes and hail and floods, everybody in the state seems to be impacted somehow or another. Okay? Now, separate coverage can be purchased to provide for these, and it may be required if the home is in a flood or earthquake-prone location. It could be required by the bank if you don't own the home free and clear. If you and the bank own the home, the bank may require that you have this type of coverage in place. Okay, it's protecting their own benefit to do with the house. Okay, those are exclusions. The next type of coverage we have is umbrella coverage. And umbrella coverage recognizes that we are living in a litigious society. People are really motivated to sue other people. You can say they're sue crazy, okay? And what an umbrella policy does is it provides additional liability protection. It augments, it supplements the liability coverage that you have in your homeowner's coverage and your automobile. OK, Okay? It typically is issued in million-dollar increments. So if you're going to buy an umbrella policy, it starts at $1 million and goes up from there in million-dollar increments. So one, two, three, four. It's actually pretty inexpensive in comparison to the benefit gain. So your cost-benefit relationship is usually pretty good. Now, it doesn't mean it's free, but if you look at what a million-dollar lawsuit award to somebody else against you would do to you financially, it can be worth a couple hundred dollars a year. And that's really what this amounts to. It's a couple hundred dollars a year. So umbrella policies, especially as you become in a situation where you have a higher net worth, okay, you become more attractive to people who might want to sue you, this is something you ought to be considering as a possibility. What else? Well, we've got life insurance. And life insurance has a number of requirements that I personally believe you should satisfy. To begin with, you need to have the correct amount of life insurance. You want to make sure that you're not overinsured, but you're not underinsured, that you have the right amount, and that you know why that's the amount that you need in your family situation. In addition, you want to have cost effectiveness. Now, there's two words there, aren't there? Cost and effectiveness. Which of those two do you suppose most people are going to focus on?
Cost.
Absolutely. It's human nature, isn't it? But the only life insurance policy that's of any benefit or value to you whatsoever is that policy that's in effect when what? You die. Okay? So you can pay a really cheap premium for a long time, and if your family doesn't receive anything as far as benefit, if the effectiveness is zero, that's all sunk costs. You've got no effectiveness whatsoever. So keep that in mind as you're making your evaluations on this. You need to assure the dependability of your company. Once again, Alfred M. Best, AM Best, which we talked about on the homeowners insurance, they also rate life insurance companies. Go to the library, don't buy one, okay? It'll take you just a couple minutes to check out the companies. And then also make darn sure that your policy is based on nothing less than rock-solid guarantees so that your premium, your death benefit, cash value, if it has it, are guaranteed no matter when, how, or why you might die. That's the key, all right? Rock-solid guarantees. Now, with that being the case, how do we determine correct amount? Well, I believe that needs-based is the way to go. How is most life insurance, though, sold? They're appealing to your emotions. They're going to your budget, which is another way of saying, how much can you afford for life insurance? Right? That's the question that's asked. How much can you afford? That's where they start. I think they have the priorities reversed. I think it's misplaced. I think you determine what you need to begin with and then figure out what that's going to cost and how do you work it into your spending plan. You evolve it. So you decide what is it you want the family to have in the event of your untimely demise. All right? Do you want to have debts paid off so that the family is free of debt? They don't have to concern themselves with that. Do you want to have some portion or maybe even all of the children's college or some education beyond high school so that they can be competitive? Do you want that provided? Estate preservation, we're going to talk more about this concept in the last evening, but what you want to do, as the name implies, you want to make sure that parts of your estate aren't liquidated to satisfy those requirements. Do you want a place for them to live that's free of mortgage? Do you want to have a home free of mortgage for the family? Do you want to make sure that they have sufficient income to maintain the lifestyle that you would like for them to have, that they would like to have, that they have become accustomed to over their life? Do you want to have child care available? And do you want to make sure the burial expenses are provided? So you decide where your priorities are. You decide how each of these numbers come together, and you can quantify it. Okay, it's very quantifiable. You add this all up, and it shows you how much life insurance you need, right?
No.
Wrong. That's not what it is. That's how many dollars you need. Okay, what are the sources of our dollars? It's government benefits in some cases, right? Commercial insurance that you already have in place, and liquid assets, your savings and your investments, maybe rental homes, okay? But savings and investments that you have. So what this is almost like a spending plan. You got one part that says, all right, this is what you need, and you got one part that says this is what you have. You subtract this from this, and the answer then is how much additional insurance you need to provide for that. Very simple. It's not complicated. It's not mysterious. And I would strongly encourage you, if you're going to buy life insurance, that you do it this way and not by saying, okay, we can afford $50 or $100 or $300 or whatever it happens to be per month for life insurance. Because if you go that way, what you may be creating is an environment that when you die, it's a tragedy for everybody that's involved. Not good. Okay? What about guaranteed insurability? Who knows for sure what guaranteed insurability is? Anybody? Very, very close. Very close. What he said was they're not going to refuse you because of your age or your health conditions. And we'll take it further. Guaranteed insurability is a provision that can be added to a life insurance policy, so it's a rider, okay, that will guarantee your right to buy additional insurance in the future at standard rates, which is the lowest rates that are possible with that company, no matter what health factors, avocation, occupation, or geographic location enters the picture. So if you join the military and you're an explosive ordnance demolition specialist and you ride bulls on the weekend and you jump out of perfectly good airplanes at night from 30,000 feet, you're doing all this stuff, okay, you can still buy the insurance that you need when you get married or you have children or you turn certain ages. You can do that at standard rates, no matter what else is going on in your life, okay? So it's very important, in my opinion, for young people. I don't think that young people or children need large amounts of life insurance. There's not a financial loss involved here, okay? But they are going at some point in time to have financial responsibilities, and this will put them into a position where they can be guaranteed that. Once again, it's very inexpensive, guaranteed insurability, and it can be added to a policy as a rider, as a term rider in many cases, so that you don't have to be concerned with that inevitability. Now, once we know that we have the correct amount, we can see what kind of or what type of coverage do we need. Essentially, we have permanent insurance and term or temporary insurance. What's the difference between the two? One has a savings account built into it, and we'll take a look at why in just a second. It's exactly right.
As long as you keep paying it, it'll always stay in effect.
Okay. As long as you keep paying it, it'll always stay in effect. So permanent is, as the name implies, going to be there as long as you live, and temporary is going to expire at some time, predetermined. It may not be until you're 90, but at some point in time, it's designed that it's going to go away. All right? Permanent insurance is designed to stay in place as long as you get it issued properly, to stay in place as long as you do. Okay, so let's look at some pictures of what's going on here. We'll look at death benefit to begin with. For term, there's two different kinds, basically two different kinds of term. There's others that are hybrids, but these are the two basic kinds of term insurance. You have decreasing term, and decreasing term, this is the death benefit. So it starts here at some given age, that's today, and it decreases over a specified period of time, say 65, okay? Decreasing term to 65, so it's going to decrease over that period of time, and then the policy will go away, right? You also have renewable term. Now, renewable term could be annual renewable term. It could be 5 years, 10 years, 20 years, all sorts of different kinds of renewability, okay? In this case, the death benefit is level for as long as you pay the premium and as long as the policy stipulates that it should be. So if it's 20 year, then you'll have a level death benefit for 20 years. With decreasing term, as the name implies, it goes down over that same time frame. So that's what happens with term insurance. Permanent insurance, and permanent insurance is typified by whole life, life paid up, such as 20 pay life, life paid up at 65, universal life, variable life. All of these are different kinds of permanent insurance. But they have two things in common. They have a benefit that's level, and they have a cash value that's building up inside the policy, just like you were talking about a minute ago. Now, please hear me here. That cash value is not a profit to you. The reason that the cash value is in the life insurance policy, in a permanent policy such as this, is to enable the insurance company actuarially, which means statistically, okay, statistically, to give you a level death benefit that's guaranteed for your entire life, or out to age 100, which is about the same in most cases, okay, at a premium that's not going to increase. So statistically, they can do that by building cash value up in the policy. How's that work? Well, let's see. We have a premium for a permanent or whole life policy that's going to be level. And you pay for that as long as the policy's in place, theoretically, for your entire life. You have decreasing term. Remember, the death benefit on decreasing term went down, didn't it, as you got older? The premium is less expensive than permanent insurance, and it stays level for the time frame that that policy is in effect. So if it's decreasing term to 65, the premium will remain in place. It'll remain level until age 65, when the term policy expires. Okay, renewable term is going to increase in premium at whatever time frame is specified in the policy. So if it's annual renewable term, the policy becomes more expensive every year. If it's 5-year term, every 5 years. 10 years, yes, sir. Why you do it? If you were to take decreasing term and overlap it with a savings and investment program, the insurance is going down, your savings and investments are going up. You benefit, yes, that would be a way to do it. Yeah, good question. That would be a way to do it, though. So you've got a level premium with whole life or permanent insurance. You have a level premium with decreasing term, and you have an increasing premium with renewable term. A question that comes out of this is, why not buy term and invest the difference? Have you ever heard that? Sure. Absolutely. What's it mean? Well, if we go back, we'll see that a term premium, whether it be renewable or it be decreasing, is going to be less, at least initially, than permanent insurance. So take the difference, the delta between the permanent insurance and maybe all the way down here to renewable term, and set it aside. Invest that difference, and you've got money working for you so that eventually you'll be self-insured. Well, we're not going to talk about the strategy of being self-insured. I can do that with you after class, but not all of you are going to want to hear it because it does get into actuarial stuff. But what we are going to talk about here is this concept of buy term, invest the difference. Let me tell you right off the top that if you put this in a computer and do a computer study of that concept, virtually 100% of the time, buy term, invest the rest works. Okay? So let's use that as a point of departure. Now, unfortunately, people are not computers. And what happens is people buy term and spend the rest. Okay? So if you've got a $50 difference in monthly premium to start, between your permanent and your term insurance for the same amount of insurance, okay? And you've got that $50 per month. If your budget, if your spending plan is right on the cusp, if you're right on the edge, it's very easy to take that and spend it on something else. Maybe if you don't have an emergency plan, or you don't have another savings account for short-term objectives, okay, then you might be tempted to use it for birthdays or anniversaries, for Christmas, right? And when you do that, what happens to the whole concept of becoming self-insured? It goes away. Not only that, but let's say that you are good. And let's say that you can save that $50 a month and you put it away faithfully until you have $25,000, $30,000, $50,000 set aside from that savings. And all of a sudden, you look at this brand new, very nice fishing boat that you've been wanting for 10 years. And now you've got money that you can pay for it. You don't have to go down and take a loan out. You can pay cash for this fishing boat or this new car or this vacation. Okay? You can do that. And that's part of being a human being. So that's part of being buy term and spend the rest. One other concept here is that in order for that computer program to work, you've got to save each and every month, not only when it's $50 a month, but when it's $1.50 a month. You've got to be all the way through the entire accounting period. You've got to save the money. Otherwise, it falls apart. It doesn't work. So buy term, invest the rest, theoretically, is a great concept. See if you can find anyone who has made that work efficiently and effectively for themselves for 10 years or more. The reality is it doesn't happen. Not very often. I'm not saying it can't. I'm just saying the human nature says it doesn't. So keep that in mind as you have people talk to you about this concept, because it is a very popular concept. And I would strongly encourage you, when we talk about life insurance, to avoid gimmicky policies. These are policies that you see being advertised at 2 a.m. on the TV. One disease insurance, accident insurance, indemnity and double coverage policies. Let me ask you this. Why in the world, if your mate, your spouse, died of an accident, would you need two or three times as much money as if they died of natural causes? You wouldn't. You would not. Not only that, but the exclusions, the definition, number one, of what constitutes an accidental death, if you take out a life insurance policy and read it, it's pretty amazing. But the exclusions on what doesn't constitute an accident are also enough to gag a maggot. It puts the benefit so much into the life insurance company's court that there's no reason at all to consider any of these gimmicky policies as being part of your strategic plan. Okay. How about employment benefits to include health insurance and disability insurance? Okay. To begin with, let me give you some questions that you might want to ask if you're going to work with a company and there is health insurance possible as one of the benefits that are being made offered to you. To begin with, how much of the premium will the company pay? All of it, part of it, none of it? How much will be the company's share of the premium? What type of plan is it? We're going to talk about types of plans here in a minute. How much will I have to pay as far as the copay and deductible, as well as the premium? And we're going to discuss those in a second, too. Am I able to use my current doctors, or do I have to go in-network only? If my doctors aren't in-network, can I still use them? What benefits, such as dental, vision, and prescriptions, are going to be included? And if they're not included, are they available? And if they are available and not included, how much am I going to have to pay? Are routine exams covered? Must I call my doctor before going to the emergency room? That sounds like a simple, silly question, doesn't it? But you'd be surprised at the number of health insurance policies that just exactly that circumstance is written into it. You have to get permission of your primary physician if you're going to go to an emergency room. And the next question is, can I go to the hospital that's close to me for the emergency room, or do I have to go to another one that's in-network, even though it's further away, even though they may not be as good at this emergency as my hospital is? How about any restrictions of pre-existing conditions? Am I covered away from home? That seems like, you know, of course you're covered away from home, but not really. You got to be seriously evaluate if you are. Is the insurer financially stable? And how are claim disputes handled? And will you support me? Will you back me? Will you help me if I have a dispute with the insurance company? There's only three possible answers: yes, no, or I don't know. Right? So we go with that as a way to evaluate. Now, when we look at the employment benefits themselves, we get our questions down to selecting a medical plan. Now, this is going to depend on whether or not you have insurance available through your employer, or are you going to be taking a separate policy on yourself, a personal policy. But we want to identify what coverage... Oh, I'm sorry, pushed the wrong button. Identify what coverage is required so that we determine what expenses are covered and compare the premiums. Compare out-of-pocket expenses. And here we're looking at a number of different expenses such as copay, coinsurance, deductibles, premiums. We'll talk about those in detail here in another slide or so. We want to read the details of the policy, know what's covered and what isn't, and if it's an individual policy, identify pre-existing health problems, determine if the current physician is in or out of network, and confirm that the plan offers guaranteed renewability. That's not always available. So we go through all of these questions, and we find that there are, in fact, four payments that you make. These are all dollars that come from you as the insured. Right? To begin with is a copayment. Copayment is the amount that you pay each time that you go see the physician. So if you pay $20, $25, $30 every time you go see a doc, right? That is your copayment. That's going to be standardized with the various physicians that you see. Coinsurance, on the other hand, is the percent of the claim that is your portion. So if you are coinsurance and it's 20%, that's the percent of the claim that's going to be on you. All right? Deductibles, what's a deductible? It's the amount that you pay off before they get it. They start putting, they being the insurance company, start putting anything in to support you at all. So that's your deductible. That's your percentage of what's going to be paid by the insurance company. And the premium is the cost of the policy, and it's going to be based on your age, health factors, pre-existing situations, that sort of thing. There's a number of issues that are going to go into the benefits and the cost of this. So we've got the payments. We know that all of these are being paid by us, and we can look at the most common of the healthcare plans. This is managed healthcare, and it's really designed to control costs and improve the delivery of medical services. That's the reason that this was created to begin with. There are three primary types. We've got HMOs, PPOs, and POS plans. This is really a hybrid of the other two. It's a combination, if you will. And you could even call it a swoos. You know what a swoos is? It's neither swan nor goose. It's a swoos. So that's what a POS plan is. And indemnity health plans, there aren't nearly as many of those. We're not going to cover that. If you have one, they'll give you the information on it before you have to sign up for it. So let's look first of all at HMOs. With the health maintenance organization. The provider network offers services at fixed prices. The primary care physician, this person is the quarterback of the HMO. The PCP provides, arranges, coordinates, and authorizes all aspects of your health care. This is a very, very important person on an HMO. It can make your experience really pretty good or really pretty miserable. So knowing the PCP, your primary care physician, is extremely important. There are no deductibles. That's a big bonus. There is very low copay and monthly premium. And you probably typically have the lowest out-of-pocket expenses. That's the biggest advantage of an HMO. The costs are low. Preventive care is typically covered, and many rules and restrictions exist. That's the biggest disadvantage, because there are lots of rules and restrictions that we have to put up with. Okay, so HMO is known for its low costs and its rules and restrictions. PPO, on the other hand, is a fee-for-service plan with pre-negotiated rates. There is no primary care physician, so there's no quarterback. And you aren't forced to use in-network providers, but they do provide very nice incentives for using what they call preferred providers. All right, so if you stay within the network and you cooperate with them, they will reflect that with a lower cost to you. It is less restrictive than the HMO. That is the biggest advantage. There are fewer rules, fewer regulations, but it is a higher out-of-pocket expenses than the HMO. Okay, so we have the HMO, the PPO. Both of these have networks. One of them has a quarterback, one of them does not. One of them costs more, but has fewer restrictions. Yes, sir?
The HMO.
Great point. Did everybody hear what he said? Said that the HMO is typically more locality-based, so it's less likely to cover you if you're injured or you become ill, out of city, out of state, or out of country. All right, so that's a consideration. Now, you might not be given an option of whether you have an HMO or PPO, depending upon the company you're going to work with, right? But if you do have an HMO, at least keep that fact in the back of your mind as something that you'd have to account for, especially if you're traveling a lot, okay? Now, in addition, we have what's known as a health savings account. A health savings account is a tax-advantaged medical savings account for persons enrolled in high-deductible health plans. So if the health plan that you have is high-deductible and that there are specific guidelines for what determines what is high deductible, then you have a tax advantage savings account. Tax advantage means that the money you put into it is paid with before tax dollars. Keep this concept in place because we're going to talk about it more when we get to 401ks, individual retirement accounts, and that sort of thing. Okay? Before tax dollars means that the money is withdrawn from your taxable income before your tax obligation is calculated. So all that means is that you're paying income tax on less money, which means you pay less income tax, which is a good thing. Okay? So that's a benefit to you. The funds are contributed by both the employer and the employee. And once again, the employee's contribution is not subject to tax, and the annual maximum contribution is set by the IRS every year. This year, for an individual, the maximum contribution is $3,450. And for a family, it's $6,900. $6,900 for a family, $3,450 for an individual. It only applies, though, if you are in a high-deductible health plan. Okay. And funds do accumulate until used. There are specific times that you can add family members to the health insurance. During open enrollment, which is once a year, that's announced you'll know when it's time for open enrollment. And then when any of these life events take place. If we look at disability insurance, typically disability insurance is part of the health insurance umbrella, if you will. And this provides income when you cannot work due to illness or injury. It's usually paid weekly or monthly and may be a percentage of the income or a predetermined dollar amount with a maximum cap. So you've got a number of different specifications, and the employer or the individual policy is going to define how much you would receive on these recurring basis. They're going to define the disability. They're going to define when the payments will start and when they end. And it may depend on the cause, whether it's illness or an injury, and what kind of illness or injury is involved. When you look at disability insurance, you have really two different kinds. You have short-term disability, which is typically 3 to 6 months of benefit, and then you have long-term disability, which is longer than 6 months of benefit. So you will know when you sign up with the company what the definition of disability is going to be, how much is going to be involved, when does it start, when does it end. All of this information will be laid out for you very clearly. Yes, ma'am. I do recommend it. Depends on how expensive it's going to be. You can go to any commercial, virtually any, most commercial insurance companies that provide health insurance. They're also going to provide disability income. Okay, we got through 7 different kinds of life insurance policy, and most of you stayed awake. That's a good thing. Next week, we're going to be talking about investing, and we're going to be moving really quickly because we're going to be discussing a number of different kinds of investments and investment strategies. So let's close ourselves this evening in prayer. Most gracious Heavenly Father, we thank you for the opportunity of gathering together and discussing these important issues using biblical principles as our guide. We are humbled, Lord, by your love for us, and we are awed by it. We are so thankful for your Son and his work on our behalf, and we pray that you will use us in your glory. In your precious Son's name, we do pray. Amen.